Imagine encountering a man whose piercing gaze seemed to look straight through your soul, who could transmit vital energy with a touch, and who claimed humans were essentially asleep while believing themselves awake. This was Georgios Ivanovich Gurdjieff, one of the 20th century's most enigmatic spiritual teachers. His work has influenced figures ranging from architect Frank Lloyd Wright to musicians Keith Jarrett and Robert Fripp, writers Aldous Huxley and P.L. Travers, and even filmmaker Peter Brook. Despite his profound impact, Gurdjieff remains relatively unknown to the general public, a paradox that perfectly reflects his teaching that humanity lives in a state of hypnotic sleep while imagining itself fully conscious. His fundamental question continues to haunt us. Are we truly awake, or merely dreaming that we are? Everyone who encountered Gurdjieff mentioned his penetrating gaze. Thomas DeHartman, J.G. Bennett, and many others described the sensation of being in the presence not of an ordinary man, but of a magician. This wasn't mere charisma. Gurdjieff demonstrated remarkable abilities throughout his life, from healing serious illnesses with a touch to transmitting vital energy to others in need. Yet Gurdjieff considered these powers secondary to his central concern, human potential. While ordinary psychology studies humans as they exist, Gurdjieff's approach examined man's possible evolution. He understood something William James had observed, that most people live far within their limits, using only a fraction of their potential energy and capabilities. Fritz Peters, who lived with Gurdjieff as a boy, once experienced this firsthand. During a nervous breakdown, Gurdjieff transmitted vital energy to Peters, temporarily draining himself gray and exhausted in the process, yet recovering his vitality within minutes. This demonstrated Gurdjieff's ability to access deeper reserves of energy, what James called our vital reserves in his essay, The Energies of Man. The core of Gurdjieff's teaching was that our limitations stem from habitual laziness that has become mechanized. We stop at the first layer of fatigue rather than pushing through to what athletes call second wind. People often seek stimulation or crisis to escape this feeling of limitation, from shopping sprees to dangerous adventures. But the key isn't the crisis itself, but our response to it. Most remarkably, Gurdjieff deliberately sacrificed his considerable magical powers around 1904. While recovering from a gunshot wound near the Gobi Desert, he realized that despite acquiring remarkable abilities, claiming he could kill a yak from 10 miles or put to sleep an elephant in 5 minutes, he remained essentially mechanical, unable to maintain self-awareness for more than brief moments. Seeking greater consciousness, he took an oath never again to use his powers for self-gratification, only for scientific purposes, marking his transformation from magician to teacher. Gurdjieff's extraordinary journey began in Armenia, where he received an unusual education, balancing theology, medicine, and practical crafts. A priest named Dean Borsch profoundly influenced him with observations about human development, particularly the idea that each person needs the corresponding type of the opposite sex to fully mature, wisdom attributed to ancient ancestors. As a teenager working as a railway stoker in Tiflis, now Tbilisi, Gurdjieff formed a crucial friendship with theological student Sarkis Pogosyan. After making money surveying railway routes and accepting bribes to fix station locations, they devoted themselves to studying ancient texts, searching for hidden knowledge that might explain the purpose of human existence. Their breakthrough came when they discovered decaying parchments in a monk's cell at Ani, mentioning the Sarmung Brotherhood, an esoteric group dating to 2500 BC. Financing an expedition south, they traveled disguised as Tartars, eventually reaching Egypt, where Gurdjieff obtained an ancient map. Through a remarkable coincidence, he met Prince Yuri Lubavetsky, who became a close friend and fellow seeker. Evidence suggests Gurdjieff eventually found the Sarmung Brotherhood in the Himalayas, where he spent 3 months learning their teachings. His possession of esoteric knowledge is demonstrated by his ability to induce trance states through specific musical chords, knowledge he gained partly from a Russian girl who had learned similar techniques from the Monopsych brethren. At a Sarmung monastery in Turkestan, he witnessed sacred dances performed with extraordinary precision, learning about the Law of Seven, represented by seven jointed apparatuses, and the Law of Three, symbolized by tripods, principles that would become foundational to his teaching. After years of searching, Gurdjieff concluded that the answers to his questions lay in the sphere of man's unconscious mentation, within ourselves, accessible only through rigorous self-observation. His subsequent activities remain partly mysterious, though he apparently worked as a professional hypnotist around 1907 to 1910, before emerging as a teacher in Moscow and St. Petersburg. In 1912, having amassed over a million rubles through various business ventures, including carpet trading and machinery repair, Gurdjieff established his Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man in Moscow. His timing proved unfortunate. Europe was about to plunge into unprecedented war. Having spent 15 years traversing Central Asia and the Middle East seeking ancient wisdom, and 3 years methodically building his fortune, Gurdjieff was poised to launch his life's work just as global catastrophe loomed. When P.D. Uspensky, a well-known Russian journalist and mathematician who would become Gurdjieff's most influential exponent, first met him in a modest Moscow cafe, he was deeply puzzled by this enigmatic figure. Gurdjieff appeared as an Oriental type with a distinctive Caucasian accent, dressed in a black overcoat and fedora that seemed deliberately disguised and completely out of keeping with the place. Their early conversations ranged from esoteric philosophy to practical psychology, but the turning point in their relationship came when Uspensky asked the crucial question, "Is it possible to stop being a machine?" Gurdjieff's response was characteristically direct. It is possible, but first one must know the machine. Gurdjieff's central teaching was revolutionary. Humans exist in a prison of mechanical behavior while fast asleep, fundamentally mistaking their everyday consciousness for true wakefulness. This sleep manifests in unconscious habits, reactive emotions, and automatic thoughts that we mistake for conscious choice. The primary challenge, he taught, is self-remembering, maintaining simultaneous awareness of both oneself and the external world. This state of dual consciousness creates rare moments of genuine freedom that most humans experience only by accident, if at all. Uspensky illustrated this complex concept with an elegant diagram. Normal attention is like an arrow pointing either outward toward the world or inward toward oneself. But genuine self-remembering requires pointing both ways simultaneously, an incredibly difficult state to maintain. These precious moments of dual consciousness, when one is aware not just of experience, but that I am experiencing this, represent our most valuable opportunities for genuine awakening. To develop this capacity, Gurdjieff had his pupils practice specific exercises. Students would look at ordinary objects while simultaneously maintaining awareness of themselves looking. They practiced sensing their bodies while walking, eating, or working. Uspensky found these exercises profoundly transformative, describing how wandering through St. Petersburg at night while self-remembering made familiar buildings seem mysteriously alive, creating vivid sensations that came by themselves without any need for imagination or fantasy. In particularly heightened states of self-remembering, Uspensky reported an extraordinary phenomenon. He could actually see people walking about with heads wrapped in clouds of dreams, their faces masked by their mechanical thoughts and associations. This startling observation demonstrated Gurdjieff's fundamental point that ordinary consciousness is literally, not metaphorically, a form of sleep, a state of unconscious automaticism from which we must struggle to awaken. In 1922, while Gurdjieff was attempting to establish his Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man in Europe, Uspensky was delivering transformative lectures in London that would reshape understanding of human consciousness. His core doctrine challenged the fundamental assumption of free will. Humans, he asserted, are essentially machines controlled by external influences rather than their own volition. We possess no permanent, unified self. Instead, we exist as a constantly shifting kaleidoscope of moods, impulses, and reactive patterns. Even the simple act of maintaining continuous self-awareness proves impossible. Uspensky demonstrated through exercises that most people cannot remember their own existence for even 2 consecutive minutes without becoming lost in thoughts or external stimuli. Gurdjieff expanded this concept by introducing a crucial distinction between personality and essence. A newborn arrives with only essence, their inherent, authentic response to the world, including natural inclinations, talents, and genuine emotions. Around age 6 or 7, personality begins to develop as a protective shell formed in response to others' expectations, social conditioning, and environmental pressures. This personality, comprising learned behaviors, opinions, and social masks, often becomes so dominant that essence stops developing entirely. The result is particularly visible in many successful adults who project powerful personalities while remaining essentially undeveloped within, like elaborate facades concealing empty rooms. To illustrate this distinction empirically, Gurdjieff conducted a remarkable demonstration using hypnotic techniques. He worked with 2 subjects, a distinguished middle-aged intellectual known for his forceful opinions and complex theories, and a nervous young man who typically appeared scattered and uncertain. Under carefully induced trance states that temporarily suspended their personalities, both men transformed dramatically. The older man's intellectual vigor vanished completely. He became passive and showed no interest in topics he had passionately debated minutes earlier. Conversely, the young man's nervous mannerisms fell away, revealing an unexpected clarity of thought and natural wisdom. Gurdjieff explained that the young man possessed a well-developed essence beneath his anxious personality, while the older man's impressive personality masked an atrophied essence. Most prescient was Gurdjieff's assertion that essence and personality are even in different parts of the brain, a claim that seemed outlandish until decades later when Nobel laureate R.W. Sperry's groundbreaking split-brain research confirmed the existence of 2 distinct persons within our cranial architecture. His study showed that severing the corpus callosum, the bridge between brain hemispheres, reveals 2 separate consciousness centers. The left hemisphere specializes in language, logic, and linear thinking, corresponding to personality, while the right manages holistic recognition, intuition, and emotional processing, aligning with essence. This neurological division manifests in daily experience. The left brain controls conscious will and verbal expression, while the right governs energy regulation and nonverbal understanding. The fact that Gurdjieff accurately described this neurological reality decades before its scientific verification, despite having no formal training in brain physiology, lends credibility to his claim that his teaching system drew from ancient scientific traditions. In 1922, Gurdjieff established his institute at the Château du Prière near Fontainebleau, formerly home to Louis XIV's second wife. Life there was intensely demanding. Students tended to gardens, livestock, and household duties in what one pupil described as a seething atmosphere of speed and tension, of zeal and high hopes. This physical labor served multiple purposes. It overcame natural laziness, quieted the interfering personality, and helped wealthy students who had never done hard work to readjust their inner balance. When the body tires, personality retreats, allowing more direct contact between essence and experience. Gurdjieff deliberately created difficulties for his followers to force them to make what he called super efforts, like walking an extra 2 miles after an exhausting 25-mile journey in bad weather. However, the crucial point wasn't the effort itself, but the energy summoned to meet it. Gurdjieff's system was based on the assumption that humans possess vast, vital reserves of energy, access to which is blocked by feelings of reluctance or boredom. The real aim was to summon the state of inner purpose that makes super effort feel effortless. The Hartmans' journey with Gurdjieff became a series of deliberate hardships. Long mountain walks in inappropriate footwear, traveling by moonlight, guard duty instead of sleep. Hartman understood the purpose. By creating obstacles in strange surroundings, Gurdjieff was forcing them to reach a certain little do in ourselves on the scale of development. This approach generated criticism. Some accused Gurdjieff of reducing pupils to automata through overwork. Catherine Mansfield's death from tuberculosis at the Prière furthered its sinister reputation. Yet Bennett maintained that despite obstacles, Gurdjieff had accomplished something never before seen in Europe, creating conditions that revealed transformation potential in dozens of people. The method was simple, stretching students' capacities to their limits while maintaining a happy and vital atmosphere. The work itself was often less important than the attitude it cultivated, what Gurdjieff called the awakening of courage. In early 1924, mounting financial pressures from his institute at the Prior drove Gurdjieff to seek opportunities in America. Accompanied by 40 of his most dedicated followers, he organized a series of public demonstrations, first at Leslie's Ballroom in New York and subsequently at the prestigious Carnegie Hall. These performances featured intricate movements accompanied by haunting Eastern music, traditional drumming, and De Hartman's original compositions, followed by exhibitions that included demonstrations of what was billed as magnetism, clairvoyance, and mind reading. The movements were far more than choreographed dance sequences. They were precise physical exercises meticulously designed to develop heightened attention and presence. Students faced the extraordinary challenge of moving different parts of their bodies in distinct rhythms simultaneously. For instance, one exercise might require the head moving in 5/4 time, while the arms followed 3/4 rhythm and the legs maintained a complex 7/4 pattern. Some movements involved counting in different number sequences while performing these polyrhythmic motions. This intense coordination demanded complete attention and created what Gurdjieff termed a new mind, a higher level of consciousness that transcended ordinary mechanical thinking. Contemporary observers were deeply affected by these demonstrations. William Seabrook, though skeptical of the purported psychic elements, was particularly struck by what he described as the automaton-like, inhuman, almost incredible docility of Gurdjieff's disciples. He compared them to perfectly trained zombies or circus animals, noting their absolute precision and unwavering focus. During one particularly dramatic performance at Carnegie Hall, Gurdjieff orchestrated a shocking demonstration of his students' control. Rather than having his troupe demonstrate their usual arrested motion exercises, he unexpectedly turned his back as they came racing toward the footlights at full speed. The students, displaying complete trust and mastery, flew through the air into the orchestra pit, landing in perfect frozen immobility without any injuries, a testament to their extraordinary training and body control. The sacred movements remain one of Gurdjieff's most significant and enduring legacies, actively practiced by groups across Europe, America, and Australia. They fundamentally embody his central teaching that true consciousness requires the harmonious functioning of all human centers, intellectual, emotional, and physical, working in perfect coordination rather than at cross purposes. Each movement serves as a living laboratory for self-study, allowing practitioners to observe their mechanical habits, develop presence, and experience moments of genuine self-remembering. Modern movement instructors, trained in direct lineage from Gurdjieff's original students, continue to preserve and transmit these exercises exactly as they were taught, maintaining their integrity as precise tools for inner development. Following a near-fatal car crash in July 1924, Gurdjieff's life took a new direction. Realizing his ideas needed to be transmitted to posterity, he began dictating Beelzebub's tales to his grandson, to Olga de Hartmann. The accident profoundly shook both Gurdjieff and his disciples, who had believed him invulnerable. This period brought further tragedy with the deaths of his mother from liver disease and his wife from cancer. Despite his weakened condition, Gurdjieff demonstrated remarkable powers, once holding water in his hands for 5 minutes that allowed his pain-stricken wife to drink without suffering. Gurdjieff now focused entirely on writing, though his style proved notoriously difficult. Beelzebub featured outlandish, invented words and convoluted sentences that many found impenetrable. After 3 years of work, he realized extensive rewriting was necessary, a task so daunting he contemplated suicide. Nevertheless, he persisted, creating what many consider his most important work. During this period, Gurdjieff deliberately distanced himself from disciples like the Hartmanns, believing they made him too comfortable and sapped his creative energy, or hemblazoin. He understood that suffering strengthened his essence and creative powers, leading him to seek intentional suffering rather than comfort. During World War II, Gurdjieff remained in his Paris flat despite the German occupation, surviving by selling rugs and running a false eyelash company. After the war, American followers returned to find him older but still commanding, living simply in an apartment crowded with disciples and pensioners, elderly people he supported with remarkable kindness. Gurdjieff's health deteriorated after another car accident in 1949. During his final days, he cryptically told Bennett, "The next 5 years will decide. Either the old world will make me chick, or I will make the old world chick." He died on October 29, 1949, though doctors were baffled by his autopsy, which revealed intestines in such a state of decay that he should have died years earlier. The fundamental problem Gurdjieff addressed is the profound conflict between security and intensity in human consciousness. Our everyday consciousness becomes increasingly limited by mechanicalness and habit, a protective shell that, while offering comfort and predictability, simultaneously robs us of the vital feeling of being fully alive. This mechanicalness manifests in countless ways: our morning routines, habitual responses to situations, and even our patterns of thought become so automatic that we move through life in a kind of waking sleep. Yet security tends to conflict directly with wide awakeness, which emerges more naturally in situations of insecurity and challenge. When faced with unexpected circumstances or genuine challenges, we suddenly find ourselves more alert, more present, more conscious of our existence. This creates what might be called the dilemma of the outsider, a concept that recognizes fundamental differences in how individuals approach this tension. Some personalities, whom Gurdjieff called seekers, naturally prefer insecurity and intensity to security and boredom, finding conventional life suffocating. Others deeply crave intensity but remain unwilling to trade their security for it, caught in a perpetual state of unfulfilled longing. The ideal would be combining security with intensity, precisely what major religions have attempted through structures like monasteries. These institutions provide physical security and basic needs while demanding rigorous spiritual discipline, creating an environment where both stability and awakeness can coexist. This balance represents what Gurdjieff saw as a potential solution to humanity's spiritual crisis. Gurdjieff's method approached mechanicalness with scientific precision, understanding that security causes automatic relaxation, analogous to a hypnotic trance state. His observations were later supported by sensory deprivation experiments, showing how the mind begins to disintegrate without external stimuli. His solution was what he termed artificial insecurity, a carefully calibrated combination of intellectual efforts, physical disciplines, and emotional shocks. This approach synthesized the traditional ways of faker, physical discipline, monk, emotional development, and yogi, intellectual work, with a fourth way of the cunning man, who uses precise knowledge to achieve spiritual advancement. The real starting point in Gurdjieff's work isn't human mechanicalness, but rather our glimpses of freedom, those moments of intensity that make us profoundly dissatisfied with ordinary consciousness. We experience these glimpses whenever problems or emergencies galvanize us to urgency, creating a temporary state of heightened awareness. This observation became central to Gurdjieff's method, training pupils to maintain a permanent sense of urgency without requiring actual emergencies to trigger it. Our consciousness contains what Gurdjieff identified as a mechanism for awakening, like a powerful spring inside the brain that can be wound tight during emergencies, giving us an extraordinary sense of power and control. This mechanism explains why people often perform remarkably well in crisis situations, accessing resources normally unavailable to them. Unfortunately, this spring lies partly beyond conscious control, in what Gurdjieff calls essence, our fundamental nature beneath the personality. The personality, or acquired self, lacks the authority to convince this other self of its seriousness, creating a fundamental challenge in spiritual development that requires specific methods and approaches to overcome. After decades studying Gurdjieff's ideas, it becomes clear that his system contains both profound insights and certain limitations. His emphasis on man's mechanicalness implied that moments of awakeness are rare, but this isn't entirely true. Humans regularly experience flashes of freedom, as T.E. Lawrence described, moments when sensations strike directly, unfiltered through thought. If Gurdjieff's ideas could be summarized in a sentence, it would be that man is like a grandfather clock driven by a watch spring, an enormous mechanism powered by an inadequate force. The problem is clear: to increase the driving force. Man may be more than half mechanical, but he can choose whether to live in a blank, hypnotized state, or whether to live as though some immense, unguessed meaning lay on the other side of everyday reality, waiting to reveal itself to a sense of purpose. Gurdjieff's contrast with Uspensky reveals much about his approach. While Uspensky taught with scientific detachment, focusing solely on spreading the fight against sleep with little interest in individuals, Gurdjieff found people amusing and interesting. His teaching style involved unpredictable behavior, humor, and personal challenges designed to break through his students' mechanical responses. Kenneth Walker, previously Uspensky's student, found Gurdjieff's approach refreshingly different, noting that Gurdjieff fostered personal responsibility and freedom rather than mere obedience. This reflects Gurdjieff's understanding that true awakening cannot be forced. It must come from within, through one's own efforts and insights. Gurdjieff's system represents perhaps the greatest single-handed attempt in human history to make us aware of the potential of human consciousness. Whether he fully realized it or not, his life's work achieved its purpose, not by creating perfect disciples or a flawless system, but by leaving behind a body of ideas and practices that continue to challenge our assumptions about consciousness, will, and human potential. In a world increasingly dominated by mechanical thinking and technological distraction, Gurdjieff's call to awakening remains more relevant than ever.